You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to yet another edition of the Daily Nationalist. Almost said Orthodox Nationalist there. This is the Daily Nationalist. I am Matthew Raphael Johnson, and today's date is the 10th of September, 2025, and that date, of course, should ring bells. Next year is going to be the 25th anniversary of that. And every once in a while, I revisit the issue. And every once in a while, I go back and I reread some of the material. I find something different. This has been one of the central events of the 21st century. Let me quote my old friend from the Spotlight, Chris Bolin. We used to work in the same office together. What many people don't understand about 9/11 that there was no proper criminal investigation. The World Trade Center was the scene of the greatest mass murder in U.S. history. The evidence from the crime scene, like the structural steel, was treated like scrap, cut up into small pieces, mixed with other scrap metal and shipped to China or something to be melted down. The public was given an utterly false story and incited to wage war in Afghanistan, while the crucial evidence was being destroyed in two junkyards in New Jersey. In the end, without a single trial for any of the families who lost loved ones on that date. The U.S. District Judge who oversaw 9/11 litigation was Hellerstein, Alvin Hellerstein, dedicated Zionist, New York, whose son lives in an illegal Israeli settlement in the occupied West Bank. So 9/11 is based on Jewish self-promotion. Once they take over a series of institutions, they're able to do things like this. Now, I think the percentage of people who buy the official story is less than when I did it back in 2020. I think that was the last time I did something on 9/11. But, you know, I've been writing on 9/11 since 9/11. I watched the very first news reports of the planes hitting the trade towers and heard something like an hour later, 30 minutes later, that Osama bin Laden was the mastermind, which ultimately came from Ehud Barak in Israel. And it was from that that I penned the very first 9/11 skeptical article on 9/11 with the American Free Press, that very day, based on how could the media know with such certainty within such a short time period. And that hasn't occurred to many people. Well, today, of course, I know far more than I knew the day I hunkered down in the offices of the American Free Press. But it's interesting that no other suspect or theory was ever considered. Few outside of specialized circles have ever heard of someone like Osama bin Laden before 9/11. I have. But you can only build a myth on an unknown entity. You remember what the Al-Qaeda's last attack was prior to 9/11? It was pushing a raft full of explosives towards the USS Cole in October of 2000, doing minor damage, killing 17 sailors. I said at the time, this is quite the learning curve from rafts to the most impressive trick piloting the world has ever seen. After the coal incident, all Osama's accounts were frozen, making him the leader of absolutely nothing. Paul Craig Roberts wrote in 2010, "How many Americans will have the wits to wonder why the terror mastermind, who defeated not merely the CIA and the FBI, but all 16 U.S. intelligence agencies, along with Israel's Mossad and the intelligence services of NATO, who defeated NORAD, National Security Council, the Pentagon, and Joint Chiefs of Staff, the U.S. Air Force, and air traffic control, who caused security procedures to fail 4 times in U.S. airports in 1 hour on the same day, and who caused a state-of-the-art Pentagon air defenses to fail, who managed to fly the 3 airliners into 3 buildings with pilots who didn't know how to fly, and they haven't pulled off an attack similar in 10 years? And remember, he wrote that in 2010. They haven't done anything since then. Now, almost 25 years, they haven't done anything like that. Do Americans really believe that a government security system can so totally fail when confronted with a few Saudi Arabians with box cutters and then renew itself perfectly overnight? And, of course, my answer was back then was yes. Yes, they do. I wrote an article on making fun of the claim that they had shot Osama, which, of course, it never happened. There's been no body shown. Same thing for the head of ISIS. Same exact thing. Dumped overboard for some reason that they've never really explained. Roberts wrote this after the alleged execution of bin Laden, and he's like me. He knows that didn't happen. The SEALs did not kill him then. But it was a very good PR operation anyway. He said, "Americans are so enthralled over the death of bin Laden that they do not wonder why information gleaned 10 years ago would take so long to locate a person who was allegedly living in a million-dollar building equipped with all the latest communications equipment next to the Pakistani Military Academy. Allegedly, the most wanted criminal was not moving from hideout to hideout in desolate mountains, but ensconced in luxury quarters in broad daylight. Nevertheless, despite his obvious location, it took the CIA years to find him after claiming to have gained information of his whereabouts out of captives in secret prisons." This is the image of the CIA as a new Keystone Cops. Of course, Osama wasn't killed that day. He died a few years earlier. He was a sick man even on 9/11. He had died in probably in late December, according to the New York Times. He died of renal failure. He always had problem kidneys. December 2001. So it comes down to the fact that not a syllable. You can't believe anything. You know, I just found out, you know, Charlie Kirk was killed. They could just kill us. I mean, he's not one of us. I don't really pay much attention to him. But still, you know, they could do what they please. They would invent a whole story. You can't believe a syllable of it. It doesn't read so much like I think at the time I said it's like a Bruce Willis action movie. I said, no, it's a Steven Seagal action movie. Recently. And if you know what I'm talking about, you know what I'm talking about. So there's been a flurry of new articles. Anthony J. Hall, who I cited before, September 9th of this year. And what I tend to do is I look at these and I rewrite them in my head. They become completely different, but they act like foils for me. We know one thing. The regime lives on war. And part of that is the exploitation of manufactured disaster to generate panic. That itself is a way to destabilize and terrorize. The responses to panic and fear can be used to strip away reason. I've been saying that for many years now. Once you repress reason, it makes it much easier to manipulate large numbers of terrified people, as occurred on 9/11. Now, if you're an American, you remember, especially while I was in Virginia at the time, working in D.C., it was weird. People were behaving strangely. The political economy of packaged hysteria thrives on the fabrication of some kind of catastrophe. they were behaving strangely because they were being processed. And yet for things like Arrow Air 1285, one of my big issues, 254 American soldiers killed coming back from enforcing the Camp David Accords, and the media buries the story. Nothing was done about it. There was no response to the Beirut barracks attack either. We know what these manufactured disasters really are. We also know the last 25 years, every single inch of the official 9/11 narrative has been torn apart by experts in all relevant fields. Airline pilots, engineers, they've mocked the pretensions of the official story. But, you know, the official account doesn't really require a lot of specialized treatment because it's been so bad from the beginning. You don't need to be an airline pilot to see how absurd this is. 9/11 saw the perfection of a specifically postmodern form of propaganda, where deliberately absurd stories are promoted by media-anointed experts, seemingly to test the credulity of the masses. From 9/11 to ISIS to Russian collusion to COVID, stories are officially promoted and sometimes violently enforced, but they're so bereft of logic that it takes a massive leap of faith to accept them, even under the best of circumstances. If the university professors accept it without any problem. These stories make neither logical or factual sense, and scholars, or academics, rather than challenging the media elite, which is their job, use journalists as information instead. Journalists are not experts in any of these fields. They're writers trained to tell a story that grips an audience, whether true or false, not to analyze a situation in depth. No airplane parts were recovered from either the Pentagon or Shanksville, because no airplanes hit those areas. The Twin Towers, you know, I'm from New Jersey. We were over in Manhattan many, many, many times when I was growing up. The towers, first of all, they were designed to withstand a jumbo jet air crash, actually multiple ones. These were massive buildings. Remember the claims about the cell phone, those infamous calls about the one plane that fought back and all this other stuff, the cell phone calls. No, they couldn't have been done because the technology didn't exist. And Building 7 fell straight down without being hit by anything. I had to go find out that the scars on the land in Shanksville, which they're saying was caused by the plane hitting it, were always there, going back 70s, 60s, 50s. A few other people have found that too. It's not that difficult to find. None of this is secret. In fact, in Shanksville, there's no witnesses saw a plane in Pennsylvania. First responders denied a plane existed at all. No parts were ever talked about or recovered. More than 200. And this is being very generous, or being very conservative. More than 200 major military and police officials have rejected the official narrative over one aspect of the 9/11 story or other. Over 20 years, 25 years, the regime's 9/11 story has been challenged by almost 2,000 major players in architecture, physics, and engineering. Even more, over 300 professional pilots refused to accept the final report. Many of them refused to sign it. By now, it's almost 400 survivors that have condemned the final official story. But if the media doesn't report it, it must not exist. Still, these stories are believed by the population to the point of violence, usually for purely emotional reasons unknown to themselves. Their cognitive facilities have been deliberately short-circuited by fear, conformity, psychological warfare, censorship. The reactions are defense mechanisms, not reasoned thought. Oh yeah, something certainly changed on 9/11. but it was the nature and style of official propaganda. Today, September 11th, 2025, no rational person can accept the official narrative, and we really can't respect anyone who accepts it. They accept it because they need to, because they want to. It costs too much to reject it. Truth is, we know that the journalists and academics refuse to do their job, which means that real investigation has to be done by either renegade scholars like me or citizens, which, you know, is a double-edged sword, but seeking the truth in the midst of endless and very suspicious censorship. A huge gap between the existing evidence and the official narrative. Even as the events were unfolding that very day and the day after, the U.S. government went into high gear, hiding and destroying the evidence chronicling what happened. I was very suspicious from the start, and it's very easy to prove. We all know there's one person who was used for this, Michael Chertoff, the damned in Russian. Zionist Jew, huge network within the federal government. He was the official in charge of the Justice Department's criminal division, including the FBI. The officials under him were very, very worried. Had to get rid of evidence contained in the remnants of the structural steel at Ground Zero. Because any careful analysis left of what was there could have explained a lot. Most of the material content of these massive structures vanished into thin air. Professor Hall talks about the NIST, National Institute of Standards and Technology, who really have to just, the stories that they need to invent and how absurd they are, but because they have this title, they're accepted. They have failed miserably to report the truth because the narrative was far more important than reality. It's a fantasy. He talks about Peter Michael Ketchum. That was back in 2016, who worked for the same place, NIST. He began looking into the reports his agency had released years earlier on the collapse. Now, when this, I have his interview. When I pub, I put this paper out, I'll have the links to it. He tells the story of discovering that the organization that he worked for 14 years at that point, had deliberately suppressed the truth about what they were calling the most pivotal event of the 21st century. Let me quote NIST here. This is straight from the Hall article. The structure below the level of collapse initiation provided minimal resistance to the falling building mass at and above the impact zone. The potential energy released by the downward movement of the large building mass far exceeded the capacity of the intact structure below to absorb that through energy of deformation. Since the stories below the level of collapse initiated provided little resistance to the tremendous energy released by the falling building mass, the building section above came down essentially in a free fall, as seen in the videos. That's on page 146 of their report. You don't have to have a degree in physics to see how ridiculous that is. But, you know, it's more than that. The tapes for the air traffic controllers have been destroyed. At the time, I don't know about now, but at the time you had the Soviet-style minders to prevent federal officials involved in the matter from going on record with their own testimony. All the video evidence has been, and not to mention interrogations, has disappeared. Michael Chertoff, of course, was a huge part of this, and he became the head of the new Homeland Security Department. If you remember, he accused those who questioned his leading role in facilitating and just mocking our rationality of the 9/11 debacle He calls us all Holocaust deniers. Well, I mean, it's true in my case, but you know what he was trying to get at here. This is the man who wrote Immunity in for Israel in the Patriot Act and helped remove all the evidence from the attacks that day, wherever they could be found. You have these terrible interpretations of the events of 9/11, and then on top of it, you had a new stage in censorship. This misrepresentation initiated a period of American-led wars for Israel. It mostly directed at Muslim-majority countries, Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, Somalia. Of course, that was earlier. But all the same reason, all the same motivation, and have left nothing but destruction in their wake. They've built nothing of substance. Nothing good has come of it. To pick on Afghanistan was laughable. They might as well have thrown a dart. They had nothing to do with it, nor did they have any evidence for it. I believe that Osama in his very weakened state was living there. And the only thing that the Taliban government asked is, well, give us evidence that he's responsible. And rather than give it, they simply attacked. However, this also exposed these huge Israeli spy rings operating in the U.S. prior to 9/11. And people like Michael Collins Piper, God rest his soul, he also a personal friend of mine, can go into these in great detail. Mossad agents put in place to record the strikes on the Twin Towers. There's no reason to believe that an airline strike on a building that massive would bring it down the way it did, or bring it down at all. As you've been there, you know what I mean. Now, many of you know what I'm getting at. Employees of an Israeli-run trucking company in New York and New Jersey, companies that were well-placed to transport goods required to wire the Twin Towers for a controlled demolition. The art students, if you look at the pictures, was in within the Twin Towers there, the art students' offices, they had many things that were simply of a military nature. And it was Fox that broke the story. That was even before 9/11. But afterwards, the network then backtracked. But they still left the door open. By now, the literature debunking the obscenely stupid official explanation of what happened on 9/11 is, you know, and it continues to grow. Yeah, a lot of it is awful, I know that. But much of it is scholarly or, you know, public intellectual, you know, like expert testimony. Now, the one problem that I have is that this evades any direct connection with Israel. I mean, out of fear, of course. I mean, it's very easy to show the 9/11 story, as it's told, is nonsense. And you have to be a moron to believe it. Then the question is, well, then, who did it? Well, the people behind 9/11 have lots of means to intimidate, damage, and deplatform those that do the necessary investigations few others will do. And people like me receive donations from people like you, so I can do this and not have to worry about it. Well, after Charlie Kirk's death, I don't know, but I don't really leave the house that much anymore. So, I'm much freer than any of these people are, and you ensure that. Then the next month, I was following this very closely, and I was actually at the Barnes Review. I said this before, but I was also, the AFP was around in D.C. I was editor of the Barnes Review at the time, and I was contributing many articles for the AFP. And so I was at the ground zero for a lot of this stuff, and we pioneered all of that, and it just spread from there. But the story was a lie that Osama was innocent. He said it over and over again. He denied it. But, you know, a terrorist group who denies a terrorist act doesn't make any sense. This is what they live for. You know how many groups claim to be behind the 9/11? There's like 500 groups. The only people who refuse to accept took credit for it is Osama and Al Qaeda. The Afghan and Pakistani press, he said it over and over again. And he made it clear, too many innocent people were killed in something like this. This kind of attack is out of the question for Muslims. He was deathly ill with kidney disease. His accounts had been frozen. He was really in a bad way. But that was just the beginning. The proofs have accumulated in specialized circles ever since. So long as you don't use Google, it's very easy to find. Google, of course, makes sure that you don't find this. I mean, you could. You just have to spend a lot more time. I remember when the architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth came out. And they demonstrated what I think everyone already knew was that a building of that sheer size couldn't be brought down by a jumbo jet. In fact, even using the word collapse is a misnomer, because the towers actually exploded. You know, concrete projecting pieces, steel beams, several hundred tons, hundreds of meters. The pyroclastic dust that immediately flooded through the streets was not unlike the dust you would see from an ordnance or even a volcano. It shows a high-temperature mixture of hot gases and relatively dense solid particles, which is impossible, of course. You can talk about a simple collapse, let alone Building 7, 47 stories, so not been hit by a plane, collapsed into its own footprint at near free-fall speed. If you've ever seen videos of controlled demolition, that's exactly what it looks like. And most Americans who are not from the New York area, they see the Twin Towers in old pictures as these fragile toothpicks in the sky. They're anything but that. They were massive, massive structures. They dwarf a jet of any size. They were designed to withstand such strikes. Let's also be careful. They weren't made of steel beams. But those beams, that steel, was very expensive, customized, and especially coated alloy that was very, very expensive. And I think they produced it in Ohio because the city was so hell-bent on making these impossible to bring down because they were so high, they wanted them to be indestructible. And all the mainstream documentaries on the construction of the towers say the same thing. The city said they will be absolutely invincible. People who were building it realized that it was going to be very expensive, but it went up anyway. There were firemen. There were no women, of course. Testimonies of firemen recorded after the attacks. They talk about many of the explosions well below the plane impact. The presence of any kind of molten metal in the wreckage 3 weeks after the attack is inexplicable. Philip Ruvalo was one of these firemen who testified in a French film, Collateral Damage, 2011. He said, you'd get down below and you would see molten steel molten steel running down the channelways, like you were in a foundry, like lava. Aviation professionals have also reported how impossible it was for these planes to have hit the, deliberately hit the tower. The charted speeds of the two aircraft hitting the Twin Towers were 443 miles an hour and 542 miles an hour. Now, the aircraft were Boeing 767s, and because the air is so thick and dense at the ground level, or as you get lower, you simply can't move that fast. You can't maneuver, and the plane would start to fall apart. But flying them into a target like that accurately, we're supposed to believe that these hijackers with minimal training could pull this off. And don't forget, the B-25 bomber that hit the Empire State Building in 1945, it did very little damage. It hit at 250 miles an hour. In that case, it was a heavy fog. When the plane hit, the fuel tanks were reported to have exploded, engulfing the entire 79th floor in flames. Yeah, no one was worried about it, but the thing collapsing. Hosni Mubarak, part of the reason he was overthrown as president of Egypt, was a Air Force pilot and instructor of great renown, actually. Said that under no circumstances could he ever do that. He could never take a jet of that size and hit that target. Many heads of state said the same thing. Remember, neither of the black boxes, these jetliners, were ever found, which is bizarre itself. And Shanksville, of course, is a complete hoax. But as some of the recent literature that's Professor Hall's work that I'm talking about now, he makes a very good point. He says, well, there's two groups of people. There's inside job and Mossad job. The inside job is really the dominant one. And I have a problem with that. I've always had a problem with that. This is where the deep state began to gain some traction. It makes more sense that there's a powerful Israeli network deeply infiltrated in all spheres of power in the U.S., including media, government, military, secret services. They're not contradictory. They're not mutually exclusive. Same thing goes for the Marine Barracks bombing or Arrow Air. Dr. Hall also turned me on to a guy by the name of Alan Sabrowski, professor at the U.S. Army War College and U.S. Military Academy. He published in July 2012 an article called Demystifying 9/11, Israel and the Tactics of Mistake. He said that 9/11 was a classic Mossad orchestrated operation. Let me quote from here. Quote from him directly. The list of names and associations of the alleged hijackers quickly surfaced in official U.S. accounts and mainstream media reports, putting to Osama and his Al-Qaeda group, then largely in Afghanistan. Bin Laden denied responsibility, saying that, in fact, while he thanked Allah, the attacks had occurred, he had not done it. The U.S. demanded that the Taliban governing Afghanistan turn him over to the U.S. The Taliban response was reasonable. Show us evidence that he did it and we'll turn him over to you. They were working on, if you remember, some very lucrative pipeline deals and some mineral deals at the time. The Taliban didn't want to screw this up. And the U.S. brushed it off, of course, and simply attacked. There was no convincing evidence. If you look at his most wanted from years ago, it didn't include 9/11. On there. And there's certain non-scientific point of view where the outside job makes more sense. because then you'd have to talk about, you know, actual Americans willing to kill many of their own people, including many elites, many of their own elite people, thousands of them, just for starting a series of wars that aren't in the nation's interest. So many elite companies had had offices there at the time. But a foreign power attacking the U.S., it's happened before. I could mention the USS Liberty, Arrow Air 1285. There's a precedent. Mossad is ruthless and cunning. He says that it has the capacity of targeting U.S. forces and make it look like a Palestinian or an Arab act. Let me quote Zaborsky again here. There's so many flaws in the official U.S. government position on 9/11 that it's sometimes difficult to know where to start. For example, the miraculous survival of a passport used to identify one of the hijackers, which somehow worked its way through the aircraft's impact, explosion, fire, and an 800-plus foot freefall, to be found by a well-dressed man and given to a New York City police detective at the base of the Twin Towers. That stands out. The superstar-like ability of named pilot to go from controls, single-engine propeller-driven light plane to a cockpit of a passenger airliner and do anything except put it into the ground within a minute of turning off the autopilot is another. Who would have thought Microsoft Flight Simulator, it was so excellent. That's all these guys have been trained on. Explanations given from the failure of NORAD have fighters on all four planes within minutes of their straying off course are so dubious and collectively preposterous. Only in Hollywood are they going to be taken seriously. The truth movement of 9/11 has been given a big boost by Trump, his two elections. People don't trust the regime anymore. But the inside job thing, of course, the deep state knew about it. But the regime is more powerful than just the deep state. It's not just a matter of, the Beirut bombing, Arrow Air, 1285. Nothing was ever done about those two things. There was no reaction. There was no attack. Israel certainly knew about it in advance, and that was the end of it. Well, who has the power to completely? How many of you have even heard of Arrow Air 1285? I'm one of the few people talking about it. I argued, I think convincingly, that the Mossad brought that down for numerous reasons, that plane down. It certainly wasn't ICE. It caused a huge scandal in the aviation community in Canada. There was reasons that Jewish nationalists absolutely despised the Camp David Accords, and the fact that there was a unit, a special forces unit, that was supposed to go into Iraq and use nuclear weapons. And that unit was on their way back because the U.S. said, no, we're not going to do it. There was some nuclear material found there. But let me quote Anthony Hall again. I can think of no better symbol of that reality than the marriage of Ted and Barbara Olson. Ted Olson, after having defended Bush in the disputed 2000 election, had been rewarded with the post of Solicitor General. He also defended Dick Cheney when he refused to submit to Congress Enron-related documents. Barbara was a famous CNN reporter, but before that, she was born Barbara K. Brachter of Jewish parents, educated at Yeshiva University School of Law, and hired by the legal firm Wilmer Hale, of which Jamie Gorelick, a future member of the 9/11 Commission, was also a member, and whose clients include very powerful Israeli firms like Amdocs, a digital communication company charged with spying for Israel and the U.S. September 11, 2001, Barbara Olson allegedly was on American Airlines Flight 77 from which she made two telephone calls to her husband. Her calls were reported in CNN that afternoon, and it contributed to crystallize some details of the official story, like the box cutters used as the only weapons by the hijackers. Repeatedly invited on television shows after 9/11, Ted Olson frequently contradicted himself when questioned about the calls from his wife. She was one on the plane. In a 2006 report, the FBI identified only one call from Barbara Olson. It was from an unconnected call lasting 0 seconds. All other phone calls from desperate passengers, including the famous, "Hi, Mom, this is Mark Bingham," Barbara's call was simply impossible because the technology required to make a high-altitude phone call was not developed until 2004. Now, that is an excellent series of points. And he's right. It's hard to tell. It's so preposterous. It's hard to know where to start with somebody. If you're talking with somebody on an individual level, you have to kind of feel them out. Regardless, the events and the cover-up was made possible by an alliance between those who just absolutely worship Israel and corrupted American elements. Yet even those rejecting the official theory, they won't talk about Israel. I mean, most people defending one theory or another, I mean, they do it sincerely. He's right on that. No one wants to talk about the Jews, you know, and the Patriots, Patriot Protestants, they don't like that. But the truth is that Israel orchestrated 9/11 using these Arabs as patsies. Of course, they've always done. I want to talk about the dancing Israelis. Since their arrest, they were trying to be dancing Arabs. They were dressed in Middle Eastern attire and deliberately seen by witnesses in a van parked in Jersey City, cheering and taking photos of each other with the WTC with those explosions in the background. In fact, the very moment the first plane hit the North Tower, no one had any clue what was going on at the time. Those guys then moved the van to another parking spot in Jersey City, where other witnesses saw them deliver the same ostentatious celebrations. There was an anonymous call to the police in Jersey City, which was reported the same day by NBC News. They mentioned, quote, "A white van, there were two or three guys in there. I don't know, they look like Palestinians, and going around a building. See this guy at Newark Airport mixing some junk, and he has those chic uniforms. He's dressed like an Arab." The police then eventually issued a BOLO alert and BOLO actually was a vehicle possibly related to New York terrorist attack, a white 2000 Chevy van with New Jersey registration with Urban Moving Systems sign on the back, seen in Liberty State Park in Jersey City, the time of the first impact of the jetliner into the World Trade Center. Three individuals with the van were seen celebrating after the initial impact and subsequent explosion. But it was finally intercepted at 4 that afternoon. Five young men inside. Sivan and Paul Kurtzberg, Yaron Shumel, Odit Elner, and Omer Mamari. Sivan Kurtzberg blurted out to the cop who pulled them over and said, "Well, we're Israelis. We're Israelis. We're not your problem. Your problems now are our problem. The Palestinians are your problem." No one had asked him anything. He just blurted it out. But even the Jewish Forward in 2002, the FBI concluded its investigation that five Israelis they were arrested. They were conducting a Mossad and surveillance mission. Their employer, Urban Moving Systems of Weehawken, New Jersey, serves as a front. At least two of the men arrested then were determined to have direct links to Mossad after their names appeared on a CIA-FBI database of foreign intelligence operatives. According to one of their lawyers, one of them, Paul Kurtzberg, had worked for Mossad in another country prior to arriving in the U.S. All five officially worked for a moving company, which is a typical cover for espionage, Urban Moving Systems, whose owner, Dominic Otto Suter, a Jew, fled the country for Tel Aviv on September 14th. Now, that was first reported, I believe, in the Bergen Record. That's the name of the Bergen County, New Jersey. Clearly, they had to have foreknowledge of it. No one knew. Everyone just thought it was an accident. People didn't know what it was. How could they possibly know to be happy or not? Quoting from them, says it looked like they knew what was going to happen when they were at Liberty State Park. The FBI report on that investigation, some of it was declassified in 2005. Even that's very redacted. It reveals a few important facts. First, the photos taken of by the suspects while watching the North Tower on fire confirm their attitudes of celebration, smiling, hugging each other, all that stuff. To explain their contentment, the suspects eventually said they were simply happy that, thanks to these terrorist attacks, the U.S. will take steps to stop terrorism in the world, which is pretty weak as a counterargument. Yet at this point, before the second tower was hit, most Americans didn't know what was happening at all. It was just a pilot gone awry. It was like in 1945, Any other normal person would think, though, no, these guys knew what was happening even before the second plane hit. Now, these five Israelis were found connected to another company called Classic International Movers, which employed five other Israelis, arrested for their contacts with 19 presumed suicide hijackers. In addition, one of the five suspects had called an individual in South America with authentic ties to Islamic militants in the Middle East. Finally, that FBI report says, quote, the vehicle was searched by bomb-sniffing dogs, which yielded a positive result for the presence of explosive traces. There was a letter, September 25th, addressed to the Immigration and Naturalization Service. Well, 2 weeks after the events, the FBI decided to close the investigation. All in all, the dancing Israelis were detained, I think, 70 days. They first refused and then failed lie detector tests. I think the only charge they were ever really accused of was visa violation. Now, they were invited on Israeli TV in 2001, November 2001. One of them declared, our purpose was simply to document the event, which in and of itself is an admission of guilt. What event? No one had any idea what was going on. But that's just the tip of the iceberg. No pun intended. Interestingly, and it does shock me sometimes, the FBI were dismantling the largest Israeli spy network ever uncovered on American soil. The DEA compiled a report which would be revealed to the public by the Washington Post, November 3rd, 2001. There was a big documentary on it, Fox News, December 11th of that year. Also mentioned by Le Monde, French newspaper, the French magazine Intelligence Online. Basically, 140 Israeli spies between 20 and 30 years old have been arrested since March of 2001. 60 more arrested after September 11th. They're posing as art students. All of them had visited, quote, at least 36 sensitive sites of the Department of Defense. The majority of those questioned have stated they served in military intelligence, electronic signal intercept, or explosive ordnance units. Some have been linked to high-ranking officials in the Israeli military. One was the son of a two-star general. One served as a bodyguard to the head of the Israeli army. One served in the Patriot mission unit. End quote. So those were the people who were arrested. There's another one named Pierre Sigalovitz, was in 605 Battalion in Golden Heights. He said, I'm trained to blow up buildings, bridges, cars, whatever you need. Those are the guys that were sent to the U.S. prior to 9/11. Well, the report also focuses on Hollywood, Florida. Of course, you know, these students, art students, all of it was fakery. 30 of the 140 fake students identified prior to 9/11 lived in that city. And that's the same place where 15 of the 19 alleged Islamist hijackers had regrouped, 9 in Hollywood and 6 in the very vicinity, including 4 of the 5 supposed to have hijacked American Airlines 11. So then what's the relationship between Israeli spies and these terrorists? Clearly there was one. We were told by mainstream news the former were monitoring the latter, failed to report any kind of suspicious activities of these terrorists to American authorities. At a minimum, just like in Beirut, they could say that they weren't, the U.S. wasn't alerted to something that they knew was going to happen. That's the minimum. But Israel still comes out, you know, looking pretty good if that's the case. It's a guarantee of impunity, in fact. They weren't just monitoring them. There was a clear relationship between those guys, the so-called hijackers, and these Israeli agents. The Israeli Hans Serfati, who rented 2 apartments near Mohammed Atta, had handled at least $100,000 in 3 months. New York Times, February 19, 2009, that Ali Al-Jarrah, cousin of the alleged hijacker of the United Airlines 93, Zayed Al-Jarrah, had spent 25 years spying for the Mossad as an undercover agent infiltrating the Palestinian resistance in Hezbollah. Okay, so that's pretty much it. That's all you need to know. Israeli agents love being art students. Art students and movers. Group of 14 Jewish artists under the name of Gelatin, as I mentioned before, were installed on the 91st floor of the North Tower of the World Trade Center. Very odd for that anyone like that to rent out a place there. Now, claiming to be a work of street art, they took out a window, which is very, very dangerous and difficult on the 91st floor, by the way. And they extended a balcony made of wood. And I have no idea what that may have been, except that the American Airlines 11 in North Tower took place between the 92nd and 98th floors. The film of the tower comes from one person, Gideon Naudet, or Naudet. And they're suspicious for many reasons. It's the only source. And because it's the only source, you have people who say that there were no planes at all. Which I don't necessarily accept, but I understand people who do. From floors 93 to 100 of the North Tower were occupied by Marsh and McLennan. I was headed by Jeffrey Greenberg, someone who financed George W. Bush. The son, actually, of Maurice Greenberg, who happens to be the owner of Kroll Incorporated, the firm that was hired to be in charge of security for the entire World Trade Center on 9/11. The Greenbergs were also the insurers of the Twin Towers. July 24, 2001, they took the precaution of having the contract reinsured by competitors. Now, the board of directors of that same company in 2000, Marsh & McLennan, it's a Jewish company, they used those names to disguise themselves. A guy named Paul Bremer, chairman of the National Commission on Terrorism, who, on December 11, 2001, just 2 hours after the North Tower was hit, would appear on NBC to name bin Laden as the prime suspect. It's funny that these guys knew that about 400 of their employees were dead. I think 295 total were killed. But they get on the air, and they're not even talking about them. They're not mentioning them. The only thing he said was, it is a day that will change our lives. It is a day when the war that the terrorists declared in the U.S. has been brought home to the Americans. Bremer, that same Bremer, 2003, would be appointed to the Coalition Provisional Authority in Iraq. He oversaw the theft of about $1 trillion intended for its reconstruction. The corruption there is unspeakable. Now, according to Hall, and I tend to agree with him, with Greenberg and Bremer, we have that's the upper levels of the conspiracy. Of course, conspiracy is how powerful people operate. Of course, we know all about Larry Silverstein, his partner Frank Lowy. They leased the Twin Towers in the spring of 2001. They were under the New York Port Authority. They granted Silverstein and Lowy the lease. That person who was in charge of that was Louis Eisenberg, another member of the Jewish United Jewish Appeal and former vice president of AIPAC. It appeared that Silverstein had made a disastrous deal because the Twin Towers had to be decontaminated from asbestos. That process was put off for years. Since the 80s. Its cost was going to be about $1 billion. In 2001, the Port Authority have been all too happy to shift responsibility to Silverstein. But regardless, immediately after acquiring it, the insurance that he negotiated was to cover terrorist attacks, doubling the coverage to almost $4 billion. We know what he did after the attacks were done. I should be doubly compensated because there were two attacks, two planes. So it was a battle, but he came home with $4.5 billion. Silverstein, a member of the United Jewish Appeal Federation of Jewish Philanthropies in New York, one of the biggest fundraisers for Israel. Silverstein, by the way, has always been close to Netanyahu. They've been on friendly terms since Netanyahu's stint as Israel's ambassador to the UN. For years, they kept in touch. Every Sunday afternoon, Netanyahu would call him. So besides being a powerful man, Larry is a lucky man. He explained in his interview every morning of the week, he had breakfast of the window of the world, on top of the North Tower. But on September 11th, for some reason, well, actually, he had an appointment with his dermatologist. He broke that routine for the first time in ages. Another article. We go back to 2018. Laurent Gaynot, who I know nothing about this person at all, but she gets quite a bit of information, or he gets quite a bit of information about the mechanics of the attack. See, both airlines, both flights, American Airlines 11 and United Airlines 175, both took off from Logan Airport in Boston. And their security was subcontracted to International Consultants on Targeted Security, ICTS, which is a firm based in Israel and headed by, or at least at the time, by Menachem Atzmon, the treasurer of the Likud. One of the worst, more obnoxious parts of all this were the Odigo instant messages. I don't think anyone uses that anymore. It's an Israeli-owned company. Those messages, employees of the WTC, 2 hours before the plane crashes. This is in Haaretz. This is in some, you know, this is in a Jewish publication. And Haaretz reported this on September 27, 2001. People knew this was going to happen. The behavior of the American branch of Zim Israel Navigational, the maritime shipping giant, which is almost, it's pretty much state-owned by the Israelis. It's occasionally used as cover for the Secret Services. It's moved its offices out of the WTC, along with its 200 employees, actually on September 4th. Its CEO, Shaul Cohen, said, just like an act of God, we moved. Yeah. The Justice Department isn't going to investigate itself. So these trails could never be pursued at the time. This is why Donald Trump has to become even more radical. He has to start taking these people on directly. But at the time, Chertoff was head of the criminal division of the Department of Justice, 2001. He released the Israeli agents arrested before and after 9/11, including the dancing Israelis. Philip Zelikow, the executive director of the 9/11 Presidential Commission, established in November of 2002, he claimed to be a specialist in the art of making public myths. In fact, in 98, he co-authored an article for the Establishment Foreign Affairs, Council on Foreign Relations, entitled Catastrophic Terrorism. And there, he speculated on what would have happened if the 1993 World Trade Center bombing had been done with a nuclear weapon. And here's what he had to say about this. If you guys remember the 93 events tend to get overshadowed, obviously, by 2001. But he said in this article, an act of catastrophic terrorism that killed thousands of tens of thousands of people and or disrupted the necessities of life for hundreds of thousands, even millions, would be a watershed event in American history. It would involve the loss of life and property unprecedented for peacetime and undermine Americans' fundamental sense of security within their own borders in a manner very much akin to the 1949 Soviet atomic bomb tests, or even worse, like Pearl Harbor. The event would divide our past and future into a before and after. The U.S. might respond with draconian measures, scaling back civil liberties, drawing wider surveillance of citizens, detention of suspects, and the use of deadly force. And this is from the man who controlled the main 9/11 investigation. The commission, Thomas Kane, I remember he was the governor of New Jersey when I was a kid, and Lee Hamilton, they kind of nominally led it. They wrote their book, Without Precedent, The Inside Story of the 9/11 Commission, 2006. That the commission, in their eyes, was set up to fail from the very beginning. That Zelikow had already written a synopsis and a conclusion for the final report before the first meeting. He had the narrative in mind, he just had to impose it on people. He divided them up into working groups, prevented them from communicating with each other, and gave them as their sole mission to prove the official story. So, for example, Team 1A had the job of telling the story of Al-Qaeda's most successful operation, 9/11 attacks. But without the total control of mainstream media, this stuff couldn't have been pulled off properly. The preparation for 9/11 coincided with the coming to power of Benjamin Netanyahu in 1996, followed by Ehud Barak in July of 99, Ariel Sharon, if you remember, in March 2001. Who then brought back Netanyahu as Minister of Foreign Affairs in 2002. Netanyahu again becoming prime minister in 2009, where it remains. Netanyahu and Barak were temporarily out of the Israeli government in September 2001. Ehud Barak was the former head of Israeli military intelligence. He had been recruited as a consultant for a Mossad front company, SCP Partners, a security company, located about 7 miles from urban moving systems. 1 hour after the explosion of the North Tower, Barak was on BBC World to point the finger at bin Laden. He may have been the first to do so. So within minutes, of either the first or the second attack, probably the second attack, before the collapse, all that stuff, he was on BBC World, and here this is what he said. "The world will not be the same from today on. It's an attack against our whole civilization. I don't know who's responsible. I believe we will know in 12 hours who's responsible. It's the kind of bin Laden organization, even if it's something else. I believe this is a time to deploy a globally concerted effort led by the US, UK, Europe, and Russia against all sources of terror. The same kind of struggle that our forefathers launched against piracy of the high seas." You gotta remember, Netanyahu knows Americans very well. He studied in the U.S. from 1960 to 1978. He lived in the U.S. Except in the period where he was out of military service. And then again, after the age of 33, where he was deputy ambassador to the U.N., their delegation to the U.N. And this is just one small part of the cog in a much more larger machine that uses the neocons are very much a part of. So what's a neocon? Andrew Cockburn asked George Bush this, and he replied, the old one, of course. He said, "I'll give it to you in one word, Israel." And he spoke the truth there, for once. Truth is, the New Conservative Movement was born in the editorial office of the monthly magazine Commentary, which used to be called the Contemporary Jewish Record in 1945, the press organ of the American Jewish Committee. We all know some of the names: Norman Podhoretz, Irving Kristol, Donald Kagan, Paul Wolfowitz, Adam Schulsky. The neocons were the first generation originally positioned themselves in the far left. Irving Kristol, one of the main editors of Commentary, had long claimed to be a Trotskyist. After the Israeli annexations of 1967, this movement then experienced their conversion all of a sudden to militarism. It was precisely then when the Jews of the USSR withdrew support from Moscow, and Moscow began backing the systems in governments in Iraq and Syria. Omer Podhoretz, who was the editor there from 1960 to 1995, he was a leftist, a Marxist. Then he becomes a war hawk in the early 70s. And here's what he said. And this is in 1979. He said, "American support for Israel depended upon continued American involvement in international affairs, from which it looked, American withdrawal into a kind of isolationist period, now looked as though it might soon prevail again. That represented a direct threat to the security of Israel." There were so many others. Marshall Berman, as I mentioned, Isaac Rosenfeld, Delmore Schwartz, Susan Sontag, Michael Walzer, Robert Warshaw, Harold Rosenberg, Mary McCarthy. Clement Greenberg, connected to the City College of New York and NYU, and also Columbia, I guess, in the 30s and 40s. They lived in Brooklyn, the Bronx, mostly Brooklyn. And during the Second World War, they were, you know, this was a Marxist organization. They realized the U.S. could be useful in combating the USSR, but they hated it because they saw it as Stalinist and anti-Semitic. And as time went on, Glaser, Sidney Hook, Irving Kristol, Podhoretz later developed neoconservatism, which retained the Trotskyist universalism and Zionism, but just using American weaponry as its university, revolutionary golem. And they deliberately chose the conservative label, neoconservative. They chose that to disguise their true origins. There is nothing conservative about them. It's an ethnic movement. They were Jewish Marxists. And Leo Strauss was not among them. Stop lumping him in there. You got these people who haven't read Leo Strauss. You don't know what he said. He was not part of that. Anyway, Irving Kristol, who was a Trotskyist, and like so many others, continued to support all various forms of Marxist ideas, kind of reformist socialism, international revolution, what we call today color revolutions. Remember, today, neocons promote all leftist causes, abortion, euthanasia, mass immigration, globalization, multiculturalism, free trade capitalism. The only difference is their hatred of the Stalinist USSR. They always are perceived as anti-Semitic. In the Carter presidency, they worked around the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, JINSA. And that worked alongside of AIPAC. Their mission statement says they're dedicated to educating congressional, military, and civilian national security decision makers on American defense, strategic interests, primarily in the Middle East, the cornerstone of which is a robust U.S.-Israeli security cooperation. It got even more confusing when Reagan was elected because he was an anti-communist. That is the only reason they supported him. It's like the Jews today, they support Trump only because he's a Zionist. Far more so than his opponents have been. That's the only reason, though. Ronald Reagan, he had made promises to roll back the Soviet Empire. So Richard Perle, Douglas Feith, they went to the Department of Defense, Richard Pipes, the National Security Council, Paul Wolfowitz, Michael Adine went to the State Department, and very few understood their true origins and purpose. And then in 96, during the Clinton administration, they put all of their weight and their money into the Project for the New American Century, Robert Kagan's and William Kristol. Concept being, you take advantage of the defeat of communism to reinforce American hegemony and preventing the emergence of any rival. They talked about rebuilding American military forces. In fact, even transforming them. Building a new family of nuclear weapons. This is right from the site. Designed to address new sets of military requirements. They actually talk about maybe some catastrophic event like a new Pearl Harbor. It's funny that the Pearl Harbor blockbuster was released in the summer of 2001. PNAC can only function by inventing its enemy, by creating a caricature. They have no attempt to understand Russia or Iraqis or Syrians or anything else. They construct them, and they become complete caricatures and mockeries. The close connections with Netanyahu go back a long time. So, after 8 months, his presidency, Bush was confronted with that catastrophic event that all of these Jewish organizations were talking about, the new Pearl Harbor. It was considered the Hanukkah miracle for Israel. By the way, Hanukkah miracle, well, that was from the Mossad chief, Ephraim Halevi, and the Israeli National Security Council chairman, Uzi Dayan. What was Netanyahu's reaction? It's very good. It'll generate immediate sympathy for us. strengthen the bond between our two people. We've experienced terror over so many decades. The United States has now experienced a massive hemorrhaging of terror. I don't know what hemorrhaging of terror means, but that's the translation I got. Bush's speeches were written by a neocon by the name of David Frum, who was a senior editor at The Atlantic. He came up with the phrase "axis of evil." He supported Hillary Clinton and every kind of leftist cause you could think of. He also characterized this. This is a world war of a new type. This is fighting against an invisible enemy scattered throughout the Middle East. And Bush said, "We will make no distinction between those who committed these acts and those who harbor them." Now, that was stated right after the events occurred on September 11th. So that speech had been written prior to this. He said, "The war will be extended to the entire world." Quote, "Our war on terror begins with Al-Qaeda, but does not end there. It will not end until every terrorist group of global reach has been found, stopped, and defeated." And that was a few days later, September 20th. So this is a new version of socialism and the Trotskyist variety, the constant revolution through American weaponry. Anyway, I've gone on long enough. I think I've made my point. I want to talk about The Lone Gunman, one of my favorite shows at the time, because I love The X-Files. Oh, hell, I'll talk about it anyway. The Lone Gunman was a spinoff from The X-Files. I thought it was great. It lasted one season, unfortunately. In fact, it was successful. The episode I'm talking about was watched by 13 million Americans. I watched it. The plot is about computer hackers working for a cabal within the U.S. government. They hijack a jet by remote control out of Boston with the intent to crash it into the Twin Towers while making it appear to have been hijacked by Islamic terrorists. Now, in the episode, the pilots regain control of the plane, but the point of the operation was to trigger a world war under the pretext of fighting terrorism. There's many, many other, as you know, many other examples of people who, you know, in pop culture, references to the attack on the Pearl Harbor before it happened. But 9/11 as a concept was a regime project, not purely an American one. Neocons, you know, this is a global revolution they're talking about here, with Israel as a centerpiece. And this is part of the reason why I reject the inside job concept. There's not a big difference between the project for the New American Century and the Israeli government or Mossad or intelligence. There is precedent for the Israelis attacking American assets, and they knew desperately that they needed this to outrage American sensibilities, and they were the only country who benefited. Osama bin Laden condemned it. I think I quoted something before where he didn't. I distinctly remember he condemned this attack. He said there could have been kids there. I tried to blame the 1993 thing on him, which went nowhere. And when I publish this thing, I'm going to have all of the... my bibliography is going to have all of the structural elements. Journal of 9/11 Studies, Journal of Engineering Mechanics, and everything else. Now, I'll shut up. I thank you, my friends, for listening. I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.